14. No one messes with sweet pea. "What's your favorite flower?" Monique asked me one morning in her office. I had no idea why she wanted to know. "Sweet peas." I was thinking of the photo of my mother's bridesmaids, each carrying a long, draping bouquet of full-bloom sweet peas. "Sweet pea it is." From that day forward, Monique rarely called me Sharon. It was Sweet Pea if it was the two of us, and Miss Gless if anyone else in the business was present. The nickname made me feel special. It was pure affection. I trusted Monique. In a very short time, she became my teacher, mentor, advisor, friend, and confidant. She knew I was inexperienced but pliable and always eager to improve. She knew how to prod my self-esteem sky high for each acting job and then reduce it in a persuasive manner so I would never stop improving. In my first year as a contract player, I got a number of guest star spots on TV shows that were popular. Emergency, McCloud, The Sixth Sense, Ironside, Chase. And I had a starring role on the series Faraday and Company. I was so happy to be part of any production. I'd show up early and stay late, whatever was needed. I had a great attitude, which is a good thing since I had no technique. I was so green. Every few months, Monique would set up an afternoon in one of the huge screening rooms at Universal so she could give me notes on improving my work. It was how she trained me. She and I would sit next to a console in the center of the darkened theater. She would press a button, lean toward a microphone, and say, "Run Miss Gless's scenes, please." A projectionist would run a compilation of my guest star spots. Then Monique would critique my performance as we watched. "See that thing you're doing with your mouth?" "Yes." "Don't do it." There are photos of me as a toddler with that same lopsided half-grin. I've never done it on purpose. She would say something along the lines of, "I want you to watch yourself in this scene. It looks like you're waiting to say your line." "I am waiting to say my line," I would agree. Monique would close her eyes behind her oversized glasses, lean back in her seat, and sigh, "Yes, I know." She often asked the projections to rewind the scene one more time so Miss Gless could see it for herself. "You're not really listening to what he's saying. You're just waiting for him to finish so you can say your line. I want you to learn to really listen. I'm teaching you a lesson." I could see it. She was right. "You must know your dialogue backward and forward so you don't have to think about it anymore. I want you to learn it so well that you could juggle the props, move the furniture, or whatever, and still be line perfect." She continued, "When your partner is speaking, really listen to every word he or she is saying. I promise you, when you're really listening, your face in particular comes alive. The director and editor will cut to you, whether you're speaking or not." It was the best piece of acting advice I was ever given. I left that meeting and made sure I became the best listener on the lot. I listened to every vocal nuance of every line delivered by every actor in every scene I was in, ever. That's when my job really became fun. As long as Monique was happy with me and I'd hear good reports from her, I was fine. During my first year as a contract player, I was mostly cast as an unknown guest star, but Monique would treat me as if the show could not go on without me, and she would presume that the show's director and crew would treat me with the same regard. She expected the same of casting directors. One casting director called Monique and said, "We liked Sharon quite a bit. We have a small role for her." "What's the part?" Monique asked. "Well, it's, a nurse." Monique responded, "Miss Glass doesn't do nurses." When she told me that, I burst out laughing. That didn't spare me from playing my share of stewardesses. That was the job title then, in various near-death plane disaster productions. When Universal Studios needed the supporting players but didn't want to pay much, they used all the contract players. It was unquestioned. I don't remember my dialogue in the first one, for a series called The Sixth Sense. I was the new attendant on the flight. I think the part called for a lot of screaming, "What's happening?" and looking absolutely terrified. I was also a stewardess in the movie Airport 1975 with Gloria Swanson, Myrna Loy, Charlton Heston, and Karen Black. Monique somehow worked it, so I stood out from the other attendants and was in half of a two-shot with Karen Black, the female lead, before she was almost sucked out of a broken cockpit window. The last time I played a stewardess was in the TV movie Crash, about the true life tragedy of Flight 401, traveling from New York's JFK International Airport to Miami in 1972. The plane went down in the Everglades. My character survives the crash, manages to get out of the crumpled aircraft, and swims away. No one explains where I am swimming to, but my character comes across the head stewardess, played by Adrienne Barbeau, who is badly injured and stuck in the branches of a tree. She asks me to say the Lord's Prayer with her. It's a very poignant moment, preserved somewhere in film history, with Adrienne dangling from a limb overhead as I tread swamp water and pray out loud. Come on, it was crap, and I knew it. Didn't matter. I loved to work, and I liked Adrienne. I hadn't been in the business long when I landed the guest lead on James Garner's hit series, The Rockford Files. I spent my first hour on the set leaning against the soundstage wall watching Jim. I saw how he interacted with the crew. They seemed to love him. He was tall, handsome, confident, and clearly nobody's fool. I was instantly besotted and very nervous about meeting him. I must have been pointed out as his guest star for the episode. He walked over and extended his hand. "Sharon, hi, I'm Jim Garner." "I know, hi." Could I have been any cleverer? Dear God. Obviously, it didn't take him long to see that I was completely starstruck, so he made gentle conversation that put me at ease. After a few more minutes, he asked, "So, you married?" "No." "Going with anybody?" "No." "Really? Do you want to fool around?" "No." "Well, do you mind standing still while I do?" I started laughing. He grinned. He had dispelled my nerves. I'm sure that would be considered sexual harassment today, but I never felt threatened, and Jim would have been horrified if I had. He was a very funny guy. I learned a lot from Jimmy. I miss him. Societal and cultural rules have changed since the 1970s, especially with the Me Too movement. I was fortunate. As a contract player under Monique's powerful authority, I was spared the sexual harassment that I'm sure many actresses suffered. None of the casting directors, producers, or even executives messed with me. They knew exactly how much influence Monique held in our industry, and they treated her and those she staked her reputation on with nothing but respect. It was either that they feared Monique or that they just didn't find me attractive. I choose to believe that they were afraid of her. XV. Wunderkind. Not me. Richard D. Zanuck, a well-known film producer, had phoned Monique and asked her to send over headshots of the current young female contract players. He needed to find a date for his hottest upcoming Wunderkind director to the first ever American Film Institute dinner. Mr. Zanuck looked through the stack of headshots and picked me. And so I went on a date with Steven Spielberg. His directorial debut, Duel, an action thriller TV film starring Dennis Weaver, had impressed the executives. I'd no idea who Steven Spielberg was, and he certainly could say the same about me. The studio loaned me a full-length black velvet coat to wear, and they did my makeup and put a long black ribbon in my hair. He arrived to pick me up at my little apartment in West Hollywood. He was wearing a tuxedo with a Roadrunner t-shirt and sneakers. I opened the door. He held his jacket open and said, "Beep, beep." Looking back, the shirt was pretty metaphoric for how quickly Stephen blazed up the road to success. Grimmie had always advised me, if there is a lull in the conversation, always ask the other person about themselves. Once we got in the car, that's what I did. Stephen told me about sneaking onto the Universal lot, maneuvering his way onto the set of every production he could, and setting up an office space in an empty bungalow even though it wasn't his. He didn't have an ego about it. He was very polite, though once we got to our destination, a pre-event cocktail party, he didn't speak to me again. The pre-event party was at the home of George Roy Hill, best known for directing Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He was putting the finishing touches on his next movie, The Sting. He played the soon-to-be-famous title song music on his piano for us. Not exactly Scott Joplin, but not bad. The American Film Institute event was to honor John Ford, director of such classic movies as The Quiet Man and The Grapes of Wrath. I was seated at a table with Stephen on my left and no one to my right. George Roy Hill sat next to Stephen, and it became obvious that they would be engaged in conversation all evening. I didn't mind. I had plenty to look at. The room was full of notable actors and performers, Henry Fonda, Charles Bronson, Bob Hope, and Cary Grant. President Richard Nixon was in attendance, so there was a lot of security around. The funny Danny Kaye was the master of ceremonies. Right before dinner was served, a waiter squeezed two more chairs beside me on my right and quickly followed with place settings. They were for Richard Zanuck's mother and her guest. Mrs. Darryl Zanuck had arrived unexpectedly, escorted by Mr. Frank McCarthy, who sat in the chair next to me. He introduced himself to me, and I said, "I'm a McCarthy, too."
"Are you?"
"Yes. My grandfather was a show business lawyer."
"You're Neil McCarthy's granddaughter?"
He was thrilled. For the first time that evening, I felt I belonged there. Thank God I didn't ask him what he did for a living. Frank McCarthy had recently won the Academy Award as producer of the Best Picture of the Year for his pet project, 20 years in the making, Patton. Frank McCarthy was a former brigadier general in the U.S. Army, a closeted gay man who had a Beverly Hills home right next door to his longtime partner, Rupert Allen. Rupert was a Hollywood publicist who represented Grace Kelly, Steve McQueen, Betty Davis, and even Marilyn Monroe at one time. To protect their reputations, each would always escort a woman to any event he attended. Even though it was the 1970s, homophobia was still the norm, and very few people felt comfortable being out about being gay. I liked Frank right away. He was a perfect table mate for me. Mrs. Zanuck dozed off in her chair before the soup even arrived, so Frank and I were left to entertain one another. The whole evening was so terribly serious in every way, each tribute more saccharine, sincere, and overblown than the one before. Frank started in with some sardonic running commentary under his breath, and I couldn't stop laughing. Then he made a joke about everything that was happening on the stage. We were like two naughty children. At the end of the evening, Stephen walked me to my door and then asked if he could use my phone. I invited him in. He dialed and said, "Hi, Susan, it's me. Can I come over?" Clearly, Susan was a much more interesting woman than I. He said goodnight and left. I don't know if Stephen complained to Richard D. Zanuck about the date he had chosen for him or not. Years and years later, my husband Barney and I attended a party, and Stephen was there. Barney reminded him of his long-ago date with me. I tried to make a joke as I shook his hand. "So whatever happened to your career after that?" He laughed. "Thank God." Beep, beep. Sixteen. Bitch.
Still not me.
Before I played a single professional woman named Christine Cagney, I got to work with Suzanne Pleshette, the actress who gave new definition to the role of sitcom wife. Actually, I think she shattered the traditional role and left it for the history books. Suzanne played Bob Hartley's better half, Emily, on The Bob Newhart Show, a major hit show on CBS. Bob's natural comic timing was his iconic stammer and pause. Suzanne's was sardonic and came with a sting. What a pairing. I guest starred in one episode playing the young date of Bob and Emily's neighbor Howard, the airline pilot. It was my first time ever filming before a live audience. It was also the first time Universal had loaned me out to another studio. It was 1974, and I was making $210 per week. I've no idea what Universal Studios charged CBS for my services. Suzanne was the only actress I had ever met whose voice was huskier than mine. Her personality matched her voice far better than my own. For the most part, I was still very quiet and reserved with my opinions. Not Suzanne. At the table read for our episode, she arrived wearing a tight-fitting black T-shirt with the word bitch spelled out in rhinestone capital letters. I was intrigued. After we were introduced, she announced to the room, "I just got a call from my agent to be in some feminine hygiene commercial." Wide-eyed, I asked, "Are you going to do it?" "Are you joking?" she answered. "Dorothy Provine went on national television and told everyone in the country that her cunt smells. Now they want me to say mine smells worse. Hell no! I'll pass." Suzanne was a living paradox. A gorgeous blue-eyed brunette who smoked and swore like a pirate. She made me laugh. She was fearlessly herself, and she was a motion picture actress, too. If you want to see a star rise, watch the movie Rome Adventure from 1962. God, she was sexy and strong. After I filmed my one and only scene, Suzanne put her arm around me and said, "You were wonderful." Her compliment meant the world to me. 3 months later, I was meeting for a ladies' lunch at Ma Maison, which was a very popular industry hangout in West Hollywood. It was exactly the type of place I avoided, if possible. Patrick Terrell was the owner, and Wolfgang Puck was making his debut as a master chef. I was early, so I decided to wait in the bar. Patrick body-blocked me at the entrance. It was momentarily embarrassing, until a husky voice shouted from the dark bar behind him, "Stop being such a twat, Patrick. She's a wonderful actress. Let her in." He turned to me and asked, "Was I being a twat?" "Yes, you were," I answered. He let me in. I went over and thanked Suzanne Pleshette. After that, I would run into her at peripheral events, CBS functions, or cocktail parties. One afternoon, I was at my dentist's office. As he finished up with me, he remarked, "You know Suzanne Pleshette, don't you?" I nodded. He continued, "She's in the waiting room and wants to interview me to be her dentist. I understand she can be tough, so if you want to say anything positive about me on your way out, I'd appreciate it." He didn't need my recommendation. He had a waiting list that went on for days. I decided to have fun with it. I bunched up some tissues and put them in the side of my mouth to make my cheeks stick out, and then I went by the waiting room, pretending I didn't know Suzanne was there. I held the side of my face and moaned as I walked, saying just loud enough for her to hear, "Oh, fuck! What a butcher!" I looked over at Suzanne's horrified face and started laughing. I pulled the tissues from my mouth. "Just kidding!" I'm pretty sure she called me a bitch. You know, in a friendly way. During season 4 of Cagney and Lacey, I invited my family out to dinner one night in Malibu. We ate at a local restaurant. There was a big round table next to ours that was occupied by Bob Newhart, his family, and close friends. I went to Bob's table and said, "Excuse me, Bob, I don't know if you remember me. I guest starred on your show years ago. He graciously introduced me to those around his table. It was my first time meeting the famous insult comic Don Rickles, known for his caustic jabs that spared no one. As I returned to sit with my family, Mr. Rickles said in a loud stage voice, "Personally, I like the brunette better. Now there's an actress." I thought my brother Michael was going to fall out of his chair. He was laughing so hard. It was hilarious. I was so honored to be the subject of Rickles' acidic humor. Both Don Rickles and Bob Newhart developed their comedy chops with their memorable styles, playing their gimmicks brilliantly. Their longevity in show business is a testament to their talent. But in the case of Bob and Suzanne partnering on Bob Newhart, I would agree with Don Rickles. I preferred the brunette, too. Now there's an actress. XVII. Hired, fired, hired, and canceled. All me. It was season 6 of the show Marcus Welby, M.D. The popularity of medical dramas on TV was starting to wane by 1975. The young and single Dr. Stephen Kiley, played by James Brolin, wasn't quite so young anymore, even though he was still very handsome. The executive producers thought a love interest for Dr. Kiley might be the defibrillator that would give the show a heartbeat for a few more seasons. I had already done a prior guest appearance and also 2 TV movies with Robert Young, the star of the show. He liked me and would invite me to lunch with his wife in their beautiful home. Soon, Monique let me know that the regular series role of Kathleen Faverty, assistant program director of the Family Practice Center, had been offered to me. Right away, the producers decided to alter my current look by having my long, straight blonde hair cut into a short, curly bob. That was the first mistake. Then, they outfitted me in stiff business executive attire, one more step in the wrong direction. There was nothing sexy about any of it. I wouldn't have wanted to date me either. No one did a test run to see if James Brolin and I had any on-screen chemistry. We didn't. The humorless scripts didn't help. It was a lot of dry hospital jargon all centered on the treatment of a severely ill patient. Nothing sets the stage for romance like a kidney dialysis machine. I had no idea what to do with my character. James Brolin was very quiet off-camera, barely speaking to me. He wasn't unkind. He just wasn't anything at all. I knew that I had been miscast. Between the haircut, the wardrobe, the lifeless dialogue, and the lack of chemistry, whatever pulse-racing romance the executive producers were hoping for became a minor bleep on an otherwise flat line. My saving grace on the set was Elena Verdugo, who played Dr. Welby's office manager and RN. I had followed Elena's TV career since I was a child. She had her own sitcom. I found her brilliantly funny. When I was a 14-year-old at boarding school, I got a package from an E. Verdugo in the mail. It was my little red wallet with my student ID. I had lost it in the Park La Brea complex. I couldn't wait to go back to L.A. for Easter break to see if it was the Elena Verdugo who found my wallet and sent it to me. I went to the apartment on the return address label to thank her personally. Well, it was the polite thing to do, after all. The voices on the other side of the door were engaged in a heated argument. I was afraid to knock, but eventually I did. The door swung open with force, and there she was, actress Elena Verdugo, standing before me. I stammered out my greeting. "Miss Verdugo, I'm Sharon Gless. You found my wallet and sent it to me. I wanted to thank you." I thought she would be impressed that I had come to thank her in person. I was hoping she would invite me inside and that we would talk for a very long time and become really good friends. God, I was so young. She said, "You're very welcome." Then she shut the door. I finally had my second chance to have Elena Verdugo as a friend. This time, it went better. She became my refuge on the set. She encouraged me and mostly made me laugh. One day, a group of us went for lunch at the Polynesian restaurant across the street from the studio. Elena was enjoying a number of umbrella drinks with her entree. I had one myself. When we got up to go back to the studio, it quickly became clear that Elena was smashed. She was too drunk to walk. Two of the larger crew guys held her up between them and we left the restaurant. Elena's feet dangled in midair between the two men as we all hurried back onto the studio lot. They deposited her in the makeup chair for a touch-up. She was due back on the set within minutes, and her close-ups were the first thing on the schedule for the afternoon. I was panicking for her, but I seemed to be the only one. No one else appeared to be at all concerned. I watched from the sidelines, anticipating the disaster that was about to take place. The director yelled, "Action!" And Elena snapped into character as if she had not had one sip of one drink. She didn't miss a line, a cue, anything. She was flawless. I guess the crew had been through this before. They knew she would be fine. I had no idea how she did it. She was the ultimate pro. Production would never shut down due to her. She was in every single episode, all 172 of them. Every Sunday morning, Elena would call me at home. I'd say, "Hang on a minute." I'd go into the kitchen and make myself a screwdriver. She would have her drink ready on the other end of the phone, and we'd talk and laugh for an hour. At Christmas time, she and I would drive to L.A.'s downtown train yard in my little station wagon to pick out fresh-cut evergreen trees, stopping along the way to get some cold canned cocktails at a liquor store. At the train yard, Elena would charm a willing young man into holding up and rotating any tree she wanted to inspect. She would keep everyone laughing with her one-liners. Then two or three mesmerized guys would happily tie our chosen trees to the roof of my car. How we made it home, as drunk as we were, I don't know. Elena and I remained friends for the rest of her life. Anytime I was in Los Angeles, I would visit her. In her last years, following our decades-long tradition, I would have a fully decorated small Christmas tree filled with lights sent to her room in her retirement home. At the end of season 6 of Marcus Welby, M.D., I was fired from the show. I'd known it was coming. I didn't blame them. I had been trying to call Monique for weeks to ask her advice. She wouldn't return my calls. This concerned me even more than the idea of being let go from the show. Every 6 months, a contract player's work comes up for review by the top executives at Universal. If Monique couldn't or wouldn't defend my value to them, why would they keep me? I was very depressed. I thought I would lose my contract with Universal as well. About a week after the season wrapped, I got a call that I was being considered for a new show that was starting up called Switch. It would star Robert Wagner as an ex-con and Eddie Albert as an ex-cop who became partners in a detective agency. They needed a young actress to play the office receptionist, who also acted as an undercover decoy when needed. I was trying to grow out the bad Marcus Welby haircut, but it was still very short. Charles Ross, my hairdresser for 40 years, did his best to fix it by cutting it into what would become the wedge that Dorothy Hamill wore in the Olympics the next year. No one had seen the cut yet. I went in to read for the part on Switch, which was described as a Natalie Wood look-alike. Well, check me out. I was far from being a gorgeous, petite, brown-eyed brunette. The show's creator, Glenn Larson, and Robert Wagner were both at the audition. Glenn Larson was often referred to as Glenn Larceny in the TV industry, a producer who would shamelessly lift the storyline, characters, and even dialogue from famous movies or TV shows, do a slight rewrite, and slap his name on as creator. Universal seemed to like that he got shows made, even if most people on the lot didn't care for his style of producing. I once overheard Monique on a phone call saying, "Well, I finally met a bigger asshole than Glenn Larson." Now, I was auditioning for that asshole. I could barely make eye contact with Robert Wagner during my interview. I mean, it was Robert Wagner. He's gorgeous. He smiled at me warmly. The style of scene they had me read was easy for me. I nailed the reading, and the interview went pretty well, too. Glenn Larson crossed his arms, saying, "But that short hair, how could she do undercover?" Robert Wagner said, "Glenn, that's why they make wigs." My phone rang the next day. It was Monique. She didn't bother with hello. She just said, "Well, saved by the bell." It was her way of letting me know I'd have been out on the street if I hadn't been cast in Switch. "They're fucking lucky to have me," I snapped back at her. She was quiet for a bit, and then she said, "Well, yes. Yes, they are." It took a while for me to get past the lashing my self-esteem had taken, not on Marcus Welby, but for Monique shunning me for almost 2 months. A short while later, I was in her famous booth at the commissary, back in her good graces, having lunch with her. "Why didn't you return my phone calls?" I finally asked. She replied with a bland expression and an exhale of cigarette smoke, "Because you were so boring." I burst out laughing. I couldn't believe she'd said that. I've never had anybody say that to me in my entire life. For the first time in months, we laughed together. After a few Switch episodes had been shot, and I knew Robert Wagner well enough to call him RJ, as his friends did, I asked him, "Did you know that I was about to be fired from Universal when you hired me?" "I did." I had to ask, "Is that why you gave me the job?" He acted a bit offended. "I'm not running a charity. You were the best one for the part." To this day, whenever I see my friend RJ, I make a point of telling everyone within earshot about how he saved my career. I think he's tired of hearing about it now, 40 years later, but I won't stop. RJ didn't have an ounce of arrogance, even though he was as physically beautiful in person as he was on the screen. He went out of his way to make fun of himself. He always tried to let his fellow cast members have the spotlight. One afternoon on the Switch set, we were rehearsing a scene, and RJ whispered to me, "You get a look on your face when you're fed up with me. Do that expression during your close-up. Even though it's my dialogue, they'll cut away from me to you." When the cameras rolled, I was caught up in the scene, and I missed my chance to give the look. RJ noticed. He dropped a prop, making noise on purpose so the scene would have to be filmed again. RJ said, "Sorry, guys," to the crew, and came over to me while they reset for the next take. "Sharon, you didn't do the look. Put it in this time." He looked out for me from the beginning. It took a while for Eddie Albert to warm up to me, probably because I was still green in the business. Eddie had a long professional history. He'd played on Broadway, in musicals, in movies, sitcoms, and hour-long TV dramas. At first, I felt intimidated. When his character was at his desk in the office with me, Eddie always wore a very bright red cardigan sweater. One day I joked, "Are you trying to upstage me?" He replied, "I don't have to wear a red sweater to do that, honey." Eddie smiled and winked at me after he said it. But there was no question he meant it. And he was absolutely right. In the beginning of the show, most of my scenes took place in the office. One day I was sitting at my desk getting ready for my close-up. Behind the camera, sitting in a director's chair, was a petite figure wearing a dramatic Russian fur hat cocked to the side and holding a fur muffler at her waist. She wore a beautiful black suit and high-heeled boots. Once my eyes focused, I realized who it was. My mouth flew open in surprise, and the words spilled out. Oh, my God! It's Natalie Wood! It was. It was really Natalie Wood. She was married to Robert Wagner and had come to the set because they had an event to attend that night. She laughed at my speechlessness. I had to return to the scene. I was self-conscious acting in front of this icon I had watched hundreds of times in some of my favorite films. She visited the set a few more times, always looking like a million bucks. She was a lovely woman, and like RJ, she was always sweet to me. With the money I earned on Switch, I bought a small house in Studio City close to the Universal lot. I had to borrow the down payment. I own it to this day. When the final season of Switch concluded in 1978, RJ gave me some good advice. Now that you've been on this series, you should never appear as a guest star at any other TV shows. Before you know it, you'll have a series of your own. Months after the Switch finale, I did have my own series, just as RJ had predicted. I was the co-star of an NBC sitcom, Turnabout, with John Shuck playing my husband. The pilot was based on Thorne Smith's best-selling book. It was about a young married couple who buy a magical statue. They inadvertently make a wish on it to change their lives, and they wake up the next morning to discover that the wife's personality has transferred into the husband's body, and vice versa. I played a man trapped inside a woman's body. I had the best time. I called Monique from the set one day. This is the happiest I've ever been in my entire life. Thank you. Every night, I met the producers Sam Denhoff, Michael Rhodes, and Arnie Kane for drinks in Sam's office. We never stopped laughing together. Unfortunately, viewers had to watch the animation that made up the opening titles of Turnabout to understand the premise of the show. Even then, it was too complicated to explain in every script. I knew we were sunk when my mother told me she liked the show, but didn't understand it. Apparently no one else did either. NBC canceled the show after 7 episodes. I called Monique. This is the most unhappy I've ever been in my entire life. I got over it. Thank you. Barefoot in Brooks Brothers. Jack Colvin. The man stirred me up. He pulled my attention. He had been cast as a police investigator in a 2-part episode on Switch they were shooting in Las Vegas. I couldn't stop staring at him. If I wasn't on camera, I was preoccupied with Jack Colvin. Jack was also a Universal contract player, but he already had decades of acting experience, mostly in the theater. As a teenager, he'd been a protege of Michael Chekhov, the famous Russian actor, director, and teacher. I tried to play my cards right so he would notice me. When we wrapped, I was supposed to fly back to L.A. on a commercial airline along with RJ and Eddie. The rest of the cast and crew were required to ride in a chartered bus. I turned in my airline ticket and rode the bus back for one purpose only. I sat in front with RJ's longtime assistant, my dear friend to this day, Peggy Griffin. All week I had been confiding to Peggy about my obsession with Jack. So she knew what was going on. Jack sat way in the back of the bus by himself. I was hoping he would make his way up front to talk to me. He didn't. Finally, I turned to Peggy and I said, "Here I go. Wish me luck." I walked down the narrow aisle and sat next to Jack. I said, "Would you like to have coffee sometime, some day, somewhere, when you're not busy?" "I thought you were seeing someone," he replied. "I was." Jack burst out laughing at my lack of guile. I went home and severed my relationship with the photographer I had been seeing for 5 years, never knowing if I would ever hear from Jack. A couple of days later, he called me. We didn't date for very long before he insisted on moving in with me, telling me that it had to be that way or we couldn't see each other anymore. I had never lived with a man, nor did I want to. But I didn't want to lose Jack either. The sex was wonderful, and we laughed all the time. It was a new terrain for me, and he changed the terrain of my little Studio City home. He landscaped my entire yard, lining the borders with river rock and planting trees, native shrubs, and flowering plants. To this day, I still have the most beautiful garden, completely landscaped by Jack. His biggest TV success came from playing the frustrated reporter on the TV show The Hulk. He was dubious about it. When he appeared on The Tonight Show, Johnny Carson asked him, "You've acted in Shakespeare and Chekhov, directed plays, taught at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Why are you now on TV chasing around a big green man, Jack?" He answered, "For the big green buck, John." He despised the turn his career had taken. It eventually sent him spiraling into a depression. I could make him laugh, though his moods were unpredictable. He was very sensual, charismatic, a vast appreciator of aesthetics, and yet he could be occasionally sharp-tongued and cruel. In our second year of living together, in a moment of weakness, I asked Jack Colvin to marry me. He declined. A year later, he asked me to marry him. I declined. I think we both knew better. One afternoon, my father called me with a complaint. At that time, he was a vice president for Catalina Sportswear. Jack and I had gone to their employee store, which was open to family members. We'd each written a check for what we bought. That's where this phone conversation started. "Are you living with Jack?" my father asked. I was silent. He continued, "I saw his check. I wanted to be sure he was good for the money. You have the same address." I choked. There was no good answer. My father called me a whore and slammed down the phone. I was in shock. My father had never spoken to me like that in my entire life. In tears, I called my aunt. Aunt Hooney phoned my father and told him, "Dennis, you just lost your daughter. With all the mistakes you've made in your lifetime, this one is the worst. You better do something to fix it. I can guarantee you'll never see her again." Within a couple of minutes, my phone rang once more. "I'm so sorry," my father said. I was numb. I had gone to my dead place, shutting down. So I just told him it was okay. It wasn't okay, but the rules for his daughter had always been different than the rules for himself. He had cheated on our mother and hadn't financially supported my brothers and me since the divorce. He had met other women, made promises to them, and left them devastated. One woman had a nervous breakdown after my father promised to marry her. She made plans for a wedding, only to have my father abandon her before the date. Ironically enough, at the same time, Monique called me into her office with an offer to play a wealthy young manipulative seductress in a new miniseries for NBC. The Last Convertible was developed from a hugely popular 1978 best-selling book written by Anton Meyer. The story follows five Harvard boys from their freshman year, pre-World War II, through the next 30 years. As Monique explained to me, your role is different from the other parts. You played the Vassar co-ed who sleeps around and destroys lives. Your character Kay is a little older, more sophisticated, and a very sexy vamp. I never considered myself sexy. I wouldn't wear a tight-fitting dress, hose, or heels in real life unless I had to for an occasion. I didn't own lingerie. At home, I could usually be found padding around barefoot in a man's Brooks Brothers shirt. I'm still that way. More than once, people have had to remind me to put on pants to leave the house. I told Monique, "I don't know how to do that va-va-voom stuff. I'm not comfortable. They should get somebody else." She firmly suggested that I go talk to Joe Swerling, the executive producer. I kindly explained to him, "Mr. Swerling, I'm not your girl. I can't do the Marilyn Monroe poochy lip, sleepy sex eyes thing." He told me, "You don't have to be Marilyn. Do your version of sexy." And that's what I did. After the miniseries aired, I got a letter from the novelist Anton Meyer. He wrote that he had originally watched my character Maggie on Switch and didn't think I was right for the role of Kay. From the start, he had argued with the producers about casting me. Then he wrote, "It took 2 minutes in dailies for you to convince me how wrong I was. I'm writing to thank you for the brilliant Kay you gave me." I know that fiction writers envision their characters in their imaginations as they put the words on the page, so I understood the generosity of his letter. There were no complaints from Anton Meyer. It seemed the more successful I became, the more depressed Jack became. He would spend hours sitting in his chair in the living room staring out of a window. It wasn't that he was jealous of my success. It was simply that he was bored and disappointed with the direction his own career had taken. Still, every night he would help me run lines and coach me for the next day of shooting. One evening at home, I decided to try out a little of the seductress I had just played on screen. I was hoping to bring Jack back to the funny, sexy man he'd been when we met. I bought a floor-length midnight black satin nightgown with spaghetti straps. I put it on and stood in the living room doorway, my arm raised up and leaning against the frame. Jack did a double take from his chair and burst out laughing for the first time in months. He couldn't stop. That was not what I'd planned. "Fuck you, Jack," I yelled. I went into the bedroom and slammed the door. I was so hurt. A moment later, Jack came in, trying to suppress his amusement. "I'm so sorry," he said, sitting on the edge of the bed. "Listen, nothing is sexier than you walking around in one of my shirts, naked underneath and barefoot. But slinky lingerie is just not you." I can still hear him laughing. We often had the best sex after a good argument. I think that was the last time. Our intimate life disappeared completely. It took me another 2 years to face that reality. During those years, we never talked about it. One afternoon, I was sitting on the floor of the den, going through the mail. Jack came to the door to see what was going on. It seemed to be as good a day as any to end it. "Jack, I think it's over. Our relationship has deteriorated into nothing. It's time to move on." He asked quickly, probably thinking I'd changed my mind. "Should I go and pack up my things?" "Yes, I think so." He looked devastated. He turned to leave the den. I called after him, "Jack, before you go, will you make love to me one more time?" He stepped back into the doorway. "Do you know the part of a man's body that turns you on the most?" "No," I said. "His back when he's leaving." Perhaps he was right. Jack and I eventually became friends again. In 2004, he suffered 2 strokes in a row and lost his ability to speak clearly. His wit and voice were so much of his presence, I knew he wouldn't be interested in living without them. He passed away soon after his second stroke. I prepared the eulogy for his funeral. Another woman with whom he had been in a relationship also spoke. She was still in love with him. At the end of her eulogy, she said, "My only regret is that I wasn't Sharon Gless." I think I never realized how much he loved me until she said that. Years later, a young man who had been like a son to Jack called to tell me he had Jack's ashes. He told me, "Sharon, the only place Jack ever wanted to be was at your house with you." I told him, "Yes, it's time. Please, bring him home." The young man came over. We each poured a drink and toasted Jack. At sunset, we spread Jack's ashes in the garden he had created. XIX. Funny or Die. Funny men like women who laugh. That's how I became friends with Andy Griffith. He was very funny, and I loved to laugh. He liked having me around. After Roots became the archetype for event television, miniseries became as trendy as leisure suits, and usually about as regrettable and embarrassing. I was cast in Centennial, a colossal 12-episode TV western based on an epic novel by James Michener. It was promoted as the major television event of the season. Many TV, film, and even stage actors vied for a role, and it would appear from the cast list that they all got one. Centennial was a grab bag of personalities ranging from David Janssen, Richard Chamberlain, and Dennis Weaver to Chad Everett and Merle Haggard, and an NFL football legend thrown in to appeal to the masses. The series spans centuries of life in a Colorado town. My episode was modern day. I played a young reporter getting the scoop on the history of the area. Andy Griffith played a college professor on a research project. The two of us met filming this miniseries. We were filming in eastern Colorado because they needed a place big enough to build a small town that could be continuously updated. It was the dead of winter, frostbite cold. In most of my scenes, I fly around in a two-seater plane with David Janssen, who played the heir to the world's largest cattle ranch. He recounts the history of the town to me in long, detailed monologues. I did my best listening, as Monika taught me to do. David Janssen and I were in the makeup trailer at the same time each day, early in the morning. David would have a large pewter mug full of vodka and ice in his hand, and would have chugged down two or three of them by the time we began shooting. He had to have been pretty drunk when the cameras rolled, but you'd never know it. He had every line down perfectly. After a few days, I had to ask him, "David, forgive me, but it's amazing the amount of dialogue you have. You start knocking back that vodka pretty early. How do you remember it all?" He said, "Oh, kid, I don't remember any of my lines. I have a photographic memory. I can see the script in my mind, so I read it from the page." Impressive. Lucky for me, he didn't actually fly the plane, since he was plastered. Being a relatively new actress, I didn't have high billing or any special perks. My dressing room was in a quad, one long motorhome divided into four small dressing rooms. Every morning, someone would turn on the heat and lay out my costume for the day. It was freezing out. I would get dressed, and then, not knowing when I'd be called to the set, I would lie down on the couch and quickly fall asleep. Andy Griffith's personal driver would invariably knock on my trailer door and wake me up minutes later to ask if I wanted to come hang out with Andy. I'd follow the driver to Andy's large motorhome, and I'd sit on his couch each day for the 2 weeks we were on location, be his personal audience, and laugh all day long. He would do character voices, tell stories, and imitate people he knew. If Andy would be called to the set to shoot a scene, he'd tell me, "You stay right here until I come back." I would never go back to my trailer until I changed out of my costume at the end of the day. Weeks later, when I was back in Los Angeles, I heard from Monique that an actor had died very unexpectedly while on the set of Centennial. His name was Richard Kelton. He was 35 years old. At first, they thought he died of a heart attack. Then the autopsy revealed that carbon monoxide poisoning from a faulty heater in his trailer was the cause of his death. He had occupied the exact same quad of the trailer that had been my dressing room. He must have put on his costume and become sleepy, same way I did. When they came to get him for his scene hours later, he was dead. That would have been my fate. There, but for the grace of Andy Griffith, go I. When filming was over, Andy and I went out to lunch 3 or 4 times in L.A. He always picked me up in one of his many vintage cars. I could tell he had become interested in me. When he dropped me off at my Studio City house one afternoon, he said, "You want to go out to lunch again sometime?" "I'd love to," I replied. "At night?" Clever and charming man. I knew he wouldn't put the moves on me without encouragement, and I didn't want to mislead him. I still heard from Andy over the next couple of years. He would send me handwritten letters every so often from his alter ego, Dink Taylor, a good old country boy. "Dear Miss Gless, well, our Sunday school class is up here in the Poconos. We eat lunch, and at 1:30 we see a film show. Sometimes it's funny, and sometimes regular, like how to grow different kinds of ducks and chickens and stuff. And one day, it was about VD and how to not get it. But the one I liked best was a show about some doctors called House Calls. Afterwards, we had some free time, and me and Garrett Steele and Jim Forrest got together and got to talking about you and how pretty you are, and your voice is husky and nice and special, and about your figure, and how your eyes and hair are pretty and all, and Garrett Steele had to run out of the room. We started a chapter of the Sharon Gless Fan Club, and while we were writing out our charter and rules and all, the preacher came by, and we told him what we were doing, and he said he wanted to be a member. When you have time, send us a picture so we can put it up on our wall. Sincerely, Dink Taylor." Andy's birthday was June 1. Every year, he would call me on my birthday, May 31. He would send me a Christmas card, too. We had an odd and sweet friendship, one that lasted until the day he died. My one regret is that I didn't send a signed headshot to Dink Taylor. What was I thinking? In the early 80s, I seemed to be in demand as a made-for-TV movie and miniseries actress. I played a lot of roles, but my favorite in the long string of one-off characters was Carol Lombard in Moviola, The Scarlet O'Hara War. I had always been a Carol Lombard fan, and as a girl found it significant that she died in that Las Vegas plane crash 1 year before I was born. Lombard was funny, foul-mouthed, tantalizing, had great style, and was quirky as hell. I'd sign up at a heartbeat to carry that torch forward. Before I actually portrayed Ms. Lombard in the miniseries, I was invited to be on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. It was my first appearance, and I didn't know enough about talk shows to stick to the subjects the producers wanted me to talk about. Johnny was trying to make me feel comfortable. "Your bio says that you're a fifth-generation Angeleno, is that right?" "Yes, my family were Basque sheep herders," I said. "Actually, I'm part sheep." Johnny howled. He kept me on for another segment, booting his final guest from appearing. After the show, I was getting into my car at the same time Johnny was leaving. He stopped in his tracks, turned and pointed to me, and said, "Carol Lombard, that's who you are." At that time, I didn't think there was a better compliment. Johnny was a very funny man, but the most hilarious person on his show worked behind the scenes. He was Jay Michaels, the head of talent relations for NBC, who handled the PR for The Tonight Show. He was a stocky, balding, closeted guy. He walked around in brightly colored Hawaiian shirts and had a very wry and dark sense of humor. He was as irreverent on any given subject as a person could possibly be. Of course, I instantly loved him. I had met Jay at a party through my cousin Lizzie, who was on Ironside, which was an NBC show. It was a network party, so I was supposed to mingle. Instead, I stuck with Jay Michaels all night. He called me Miss Gless. Always Miss Gless. Judith Ann, my best friend from childhood, signed on as the third side of our Bermuda Triangle friendship. On weekends, the three of us would completely go off the radar and disappear for 2 days, sucked into a haze of booze and cocaine. I'd bring my cocaine grinder and some coke, Judith Ann would bring snacks and mixers, and Jay would bring liquor, and tonight show beach towels or some other gift meant for guests of the show. We thought we were so fascinating that we wouldn't sleep for 48 hours straight. The cocaine helped with that. Hey, it was the 80s. Like Andy Griffith, Jay sent me the most memorable and funny correspondences, always unexpected. One night, Monique called me at 10 p.m. Angie Dickinson had dropped out of a TV movie, Revenge of the Stepford Wives, due to the unexpected death of her mother. It was scheduled to begin filming the following morning. NBC sent out the call for me to step in. I had never even seen the original Stepford Wives feature film, so I didn't know what it was about. I had to meet up with the wardrobe department at about midnight to be fitted for my costumes, including the pinafore dresses. At the same time, I was attempting to speed-read the script to figure out my character. I pulled an all-nighter trying to get ready. The next morning, I was on the set at sunrise with the rest of the cast and crew. The movie was filmed in a luxury home in Calabasas, California. Everyone else seemed ready to go. I was nervous. A young page from NBC showed up with a sealed letter that he was to deliver to Sharon Gless. I knew it had to be important. On the front of the envelope was printed, "To the beautiful blonde star of the Stepford Wives, from a very important NBC executive." It was obviously from Jay. It was formally written on NBC stationery and read, "Dearest Angie, welcome back to NBC. We are so delighted that you're with us again. We were worried sick that we would have to get some silly twat Universal contract player to play the part. My best to Bert, Jay Michaels." It was so funny, and was exactly what I needed to soothe my nerves. I gave the part my all. It was no Handmaid's Tale, but I got to be the hero in 1980, when female hero characters were few in number. For the first time in my career, I was billed alone over the title. 6 years later, the morning after I had won my first Emmy Award for Cagney and Lacey, another NBC page delivered a small package to my home. NBC had produced and aired the Emmys that year. I thought I was getting a congratulatory gift. Inside was one lone anchovy in a small plastic container. The NBC engraved card read, "Ms. Gless, we were cleaning up the auditorium last night, and in all of the excitement, found this left behind on your seat." Jay's viewpoint was always, "Who needs a bouquet of congratulatory flowers delivered when a rude body substance joke would be so much more personal?" Jay also never censored where or when was an appropriate time to talk about his exaggerations of my sexual predilections. At the buffet reception following my father's funeral, I took my plate to sit at a table with Jay and some of my favorite male friends. As I pulled out my chair, Jay said loudly, "Okay, anyone at this table who has not had Miss Gless, raise your hand." Jay's hand went up in the air. Next to me sat Barney Rosenzweig, the executive producer of Cagney and Lacey. He also raised his hand. It was very classy of him, considering we had been having an affair for most of season 6. He was the only one at the table with whom I was actually involved. And Jay knew it, despite his insinuation that I would give it up to anyone at the slightest invitation. I'd won the Emmy for Best Actress for the 4th and 5th seasons of Cagney and Lacey. Both of my winning episodes were directed by Sharon Miller. Tyne Daly had garnered the prize for the first 3 seasons of the show. We were both, once again, nominated for season 6. Lorne Michaels of Saturday Night Live was producing the Emmys that year and asked me for a favor. Backstage during rehearsal, Lorne said, "Never before have we had a nominee present an award after their category. If they don't win, they feel awful." I said, "No problem, I can do it, I'm used to it." He handed me 2 speeches, one for if I had just won, and the other if I hadn't. I hadn't. Tyne had. I still went on. I walked to the podium. I fumbled with my glasses for a moment. Then I sighed and said, "Forgive me, as you know, I just lost." I had two speeches ready to present this next award. Being a positive thinker, I memorized the winning speech. Excuse me, I'll have to use my glasses to read this one. The audience started cheering for me. The speech was a hysterical put-down of the Emmy Committee, written by Lorne himself, where I referred to them as an uneducated, arbitrary group with no taste. It brought down the house. Jay, who was sitting next to Judith Ann, turned to her and said, "She just won. No one's going to remember anything else about this show tonight." A few weeks after my father's death, I was sitting on my couch in my Studio City home when my publicist, Pat Kingsley, called to tell me that Jay was dead. He had died in his sleep. I went to stand up and my legs gave out from under me. I fell to the floor. NBC knew Jay Michaels was irreplaceable. Over time, they hired three people to fill his one position. The week he passed away, NBC did a silent tribute to his memory. Instead of the NBC logo appearing in living color in the full-page ad in The Hollywood Reporter and Daily Variety, the famous peacock image was in shades of gray. A feather had fallen from the bird's plume and lay alone in its feet. There was one tear running down the peacock's face. The print read, "We will never be the same." I thought it was wonderful. Jay would have crucified it. Every ounce of comic timing I have is a result of the encouragement and humor of a handful of feisty female soulmates. Over the years, they have been my playmates, my confidants, my prankster pals, my sure things, and my early audience. They each have defined me in different ways. The only gift in my having to join the snooty Hancock Park Bluebirds troupe as a 7-year-old was Susan Binney, another little blonde-haired, blue-eyed girl who accepted me without hesitation. I liked her right away. She would come over and spend the night almost every weekend. She thought I was a laugh riot, and I would push the limits of my mother's patience to keep Susan's joy at a peak. Every Easter, Susan would always take me to her grandmother's home in Balboa, near Newport Beach. My mother would send me with a box of Demet's turtles as a house present. In the car, on the way there, I would open the box. Susan would eat one, and I would consume row after row and hand it back to her almost empty. Only Susan would find that hysterically funny. Years later, when I was maid of honor at Susan's wedding, a part of me was afraid that I was losing her. But I knew nothing of really losing her until I actually did in 2018 when she died of brain cancer. About a week before Susan passed, when she was no longer communicating and spent most of the day sleeping, I sent her a box of Demet's turtles. I removed all but two. I ate half of one, put it back in the box, and left the last one whole. I had it delivered to her door. Her husband called me saying, "Sharon, I got the turtles you sent, Sue. She hasn't spoken in a week. She won't know what this is. She's failing." I said, "Please, Tom, tell her it's from Sharon and open the box for her." He agreed hesitantly. 5 minutes later, he called me back, tears in his voice. "She started laughing," Tom told me. I knew my girl. "Thank you, Sue, for your parting gift." Julie Cheesewright was my friend from boarding school. The evening that the school closed for the Christmas break, all of the girls would go caroling in the Monterey neighborhood. Then Julie and I and three other L.A. area girls would be put on the overnight train in sleeper cars from Monterey to Los Angeles. It was one of my favorite nights of the year. We would stay awake as long as we could and laugh and talk all the way home. Julie was the most girly girl I had ever known. She was feminine in every way. We were debutantes together, and Julie found her husband to be Bill soon after. As a gift for her wedding night, I went to a sports store and bought her a men's white sweatsuit and a white football helmet. I sewed pink gingham ribbons onto the sweatsuit and glued ribbons along the helmet. Julie howled with laughter when she opened my gift. She later told me that on her wedding night, she emerged from the bathroom in the helmet and sweatsuit before her waiting groom. Brava, Julie! The day before I won my first Emmy in 1986, I visited Julie's hospital room in San Francisco, where she was being treated for a brain tumor. I told her that I thought I might finally win. She was no longer speaking. She cooed her joy. Bill called me with congratulations the next night. He and Julie had watched the Emmys. She passed away 2 days later. I had a lifelong bond with my cousin Elizabeth, who was born when I was 3, the only child of my most loved Aunt Eunie and Uncle Jack. After Uncle Jack returned home from the war in Europe, all 3 of them lived with us in the Muirfield house while their new home was under construction. For a bit, I was displaced and unhappy at losing my status as the baby, but I couldn't stop myself from falling in love with Lizzie, my curly-haired brunette cousin. Aunt Eunie and Uncle Jack would often take me on vacations with them, and Lizzie spent many overnights at my house. Even as adults, we spent many weekends together, and in our early 20s, we rented an apartment together on the beach in Laguna, where we spent our summer months. Her father, the casting director, also wanted his only child to stay as far away from show business as possible. She defied that wish at age 19 and was one of 20th Century Fox's up-and-coming actresses in training, along with Jacqueline Bisset and James Brolin. At age 21, beautiful, talented Elizabeth Bower beat out 100 other hopeful young women to play alongside Raymond Burr in Ironside at Universal. Lizzie and I were as close as it comes, until cancer took her life in the fall of 2017. Lizzie promised me that when it was my turn to go, she would be there, waiting with a luggage cart to welcome me. That will be heaven. For now, I miss her every day. Finally, there was one girl who held the most sway in my young life, but not always for the good. Judith Ann. My mother and her mother were best friends and were happy when they both gave birth to girls 1 month apart. Her family had a vacation house in Hermosa Beach where my mother, brothers, and I would spend 2 weeks every summer. On summer days, I was always dressed in my brother's hand-me-down T-shirts and some type of cotton shorts. Judith Ann would be dolled up in a frilly sunsuit. She always envied my clothes, and I coveted hers. As soon as we could get out of the sight of the adults, we would strip down and exchange outfits. Judith Ann was far more mischievous than I. When we were preteens attending cotillion, she figured out where the breaker switch was and cast the entire ballroom and the many attendees who were enjoying their punch into pitch darkness. Then we ran off to stand on the toilet seats in the bathroom stalls to hide from the patronesses who came looking for the culprits. There seemed to be infinite ways that Judith Ann could get us into trouble, but I followed her anywhere she went, happily enlisted to help pull off pranks for the first 6 decades of our lives. The only thing Judith Ann couldn't pull off was surviving her 10-year struggle with breast cancer. When she had to tell me that the fight was over, we were having lunch in a restaurant. Judith Ann leaned over and said softly, "I'm so sorry that I can't keep my promise that we'll grow old together." I was devastated, but I wanted to make her feel better. So I whispered back, "I think 60 years is a fucking good run." She smiled. "It is, isn't it?" In my eulogy to Judith Ann, I said, "60 years ago, they put us in a crib together. I fell in love and I never recovered." No one really knows the rhyme or reason of why one person can thrive and another falls ill.
I smoked and drank for decades of my life. I still eat crap. My compromise is to eat a full bowl of blueberries every day. I've dieted and fasted and overeaten and lived on peanut brittle, ice cream sandwiches, or See's lollipops for a day. I don't drink much water, and I find most vegetables completely boring. How did I luck out? Every play has its characters. These smart, sassy, and supportive female friends were a few of mine. I've somehow made it into the third act, but the appeal of the full show has diminished with their passing. There's no sufficient dialogue to make sense of it, except two words. Fuck cancer.